Chapter 10 Animals Take the Stage. In latest Proterozoic rocks, we find at last what Charles Darwin predicted long ago, the fossilized impressions of early animals. But the fossils are not at all what Darwin expected. The ancestors of modern animals undoubtedly lived in latest Proterozoic seaways, but most end-Proterozoic fossils have unusual forms that separate them from, rather than link them to, Cambrian and younger faunas. For paleontologists weaned on Arctic research, the sun sets early in Namibia. By 6 p.m., packs and hammers must be stowed, and if we're not to stumble around by flashlight, firewood must be gathered. Temperatures may have reached 100 degrees Fahrenheit in the afternoon, but by morning our sleeping bags will be rimmed by frost. As daylight wanes, the stark hills and fantastic shrubs of southwestern Africa fade from view. But even as they disappear, a new wonder takes shape in the evening sky. The Milky Way, seen through clear desert air. Untold millions of stars form a broad arc across the southern sky, stars so densely packed that Aboriginal Australians found their constellations in patches of emptiness amid the glimmer, rather than by connecting sparse points of light. Every few minutes, a meteor streaks across our celestial canopy. The stars make good companions as we drift toward sleep, tightly wrapped against the cooling night air. But sleep can be fitful in the desert. The stars may disappear behind a curtain of clouds, prompting the worry that we'll soon be wet as well as cold. Or zebras may amble past camp, their quiet hoof-falls nudging weary geologists awake. Other animals are less respectful. More than once I've been awakened by piercing shrieks just beyond our fading campfire. A troop of baboons, irritated by human interlopers. Eventually, however, sleep returns until an amber rim on the eastern horizon heralds the end of stars and cold, and the start of a new working day. The fossils of Gunflint and Spitsbergen offer few clues to the origins of creatures like zebras and baboons. Even Daushantuo phosphorites, formed just 50 million years before the Cambrian cliffs in Siberia, contain only microscopic hints of gathering animal evolution. But here, in Namibian rocks deposited at the very end of the Proterozoic Aeon, figure 10.1, and in beds of comparable age around the world, we see at last the palpable fuse of Cambrian explosion. Large animals that plausibly include the ancestors of our familiar biota. In some ways, it marks the realization of Darwin's dream, animal life before the Cambrian. But Namibian fossils also deepen Darwin's dilemma, because their unusual shapes challenge our efforts to locate them on the Tree of Life. Do these remains really trace a path to modern animals? Or are they a dead-end fork on the evolutionary road? I first visited Namibia more than 20 years ago, in the company of South African geologist Gerard Herms. A gentleman of philosophical bent, Herms emigrated from the Netherlands as a graduate student and took up the challenge of bringing geologic order to a poorly known region the size of Texas. His success laid the foundation for continuing research that has changed the way we think about early animal evolution. Much of that research has been directed by MIT's John Grotzinger, architect of our modern understanding of these rocks and their paleontological riches. John's driving desire is to understand how sedimentary rocks accumulate, and especially to know how they did so on the early Earth, when life and environments differed from today. To address these issues, he must find places where thick successions of ancient rocks are exceptionally well-preserved and unusually well-exposed. Southern Namibia fits the bill perfectly. Its Proterozoic sediments remain almost untouched by tectonics or metamorphism, but they are dissected by canyons that allow geologists to map stratigraphic relationships in three-dimensional detail. With his students, John has taken the latest Proterozoic rocks of Namibia apart and put them back together, in the process learning how tectonics, sea level, climate, and biology shaped the sedimentary record seen today. Along the way, he has discovered a host of new fossils, including large reefs built by microorganisms but bristling with the skeletons of early animals. It was the opportunity to study those skeletons that lured me back to Namibia. Sedimentary rocks of the Nama group accumulated in a broad basin formed in response to continental collisions that forged the supercontinent Gondwana. In its lowermost part, the Nama succession consists of pebbly and conglomeratic sandstones formed on an ancient coastal plain. Above these are finer-grained sandstones deposited along an ancient coastline, followed by siltstones and shales deposited farther offshore. In the basin center, beyond the reach of silt and mud, limestones precipitated from clear waters. Light green ash beds, introduced by nearby volcanoes, preserve a record of time. Deposition began about 550 million years ago and continued until the very end of the Proterozoic, 543 million years ago, when uplift and erosion carved deep canyons into underlying rocks. These paleocanyons are filled by more sandstones and shales. Diverse trace fossils and a 539 million plus or minus 1 million year old ash bed indicate that when Nama sedimentation resumed, the Cambrian period was already underway. The conventional hallmarks of Proterozoic biology, seen before from Spitsbergen to Siberia, appear once more in these Namibian rocks. Stromatolites are conspicuous, if not abundant, features of Nama limestones, and in Nama shales, cyanobacterial filaments lie buried with simple algal microfossils. Here then, just below the Cambrian boundary, the paleontology still looks, well, Proterozoic. But there is a difference. If we examine Nama sandstones carefully, preferably in late afternoon when the sun, set low in the sky, throws surface features into high relief, we see fossils that are almost shockingly different from anything found in older rocks. We see the impressions of large, complicated organisms, as well as simple tracks and trails unambiguously made by animals. In truth, the Nama fossils are shocking whether we approach them from above or below, for if they have no counterparts in older beds, Nama impressions bear equally little resemblance to most fossils found in Cambrian or younger rocks. Thus, the debate: do the remarkable fossils in Nama and other latest Proterozoic rocks record the ancestors of modern animals, or a failed evolutionary experiment at the dawn of animal evolution? Fossils were discovered in Nama rocks as early as 1908, and between 1929 and 1933, the German paleontologist Gurisch provided detailed descriptions of several species. Not much was made of this discovery, however, perhaps because the biological and geological frameworks needed to understand its importance were not yet in place. Scientists didn't fully appreciate either the genealogical relationships we know from the Tree of Life or the time relationships among ancient rocks. By 1946, however, when Reg Sprigg began to uncover similar assemblages in the remote Ediacara Hills of South Australia, the necessary frameworks had begun to take shape. Moreover, the Australian fossils found a worthy champion in the great paleontologist Martin Glasner, along with Barghorn Cloud and Timofeev, the fourth patriarch of Precambrian paleobiology. Ediacaran fossils, as they came to be known, were interpreted by Glasner and many who followed as the exposed roots of the metazoan tree, the earliest representatives of animal phyla that blossomed into diversity in the ensuing Cambrian. Glasner took an active interest in the Ediacaran fossils of Namibia, but it was discoveries in the 1970s by Gerard Herms and Hans Fluke of Gießen University in Germany that rekindled paleontological interest in Nama rocks. Another German scientist stirred the pot as well. In 1984, Adolf Zeilacher, one of the world's most distinguished paleontologists, announced that Glasner had gotten it all wrong. One more time, we must ask how paleontologists interpret fossils. How, in this particular case, do they coax biology from Ediacaran impressions, casts, and molds? Evidence of anatomy or physiology was stripped away shortly after the carcasses were impressed into surrounding beds, leaving only form to guide our interpretations. Of course, morphology is usually all that remains for paleontologists to ponder. Dinosaurs left only their bones, and rarely traces of skin. But that's enough to reveal volumes about their biology, because dinosaur backbones, ribs, and teeth display morphological landmarks that relate them unambiguously to vertebrate animals alive today. The same is true for trilobites. They may be long extinct, but their segmented bodies and jointed legs tie them to living horseshoe crabs, shrimp, and other arthropods. Therein lies the problem. The impressions in Namibian sandstones have unfamiliar shapes, making it difficult, if not impossible, to map their features onto the forms of living animals. The simplest impressions in Nama rocks are shallow discs up to a few inches across, the kind of fossils one might expect to be formed by jellyfish buried in a storm. Indeed, for many years, jellyfish were considered likely counterparts of these fossils. But this interpretation has a serious flaw. Disc-like fossils are common in Ediacaran age sandstones, and nearly all occur as casts that bulge downward from the bottoms of sandstone beds. In other words, they are casts of organisms that formed depressions in the shallow seafloor. For jellyfish to form such fossils, they would have had to land upside down, and with considerable impact, when cast onto sediment surfaces. We need only stroll along a beach in the wake of a storm to convince ourselves that this is not how jellyfish land. More likely, the disc-like fossils lived on the seafloor, nestled into sediments much like modern sea anemones, bottom-dwelling cousins of the jellyfish. Other discoidal fossils represent originally bulbous or conical holdfasts or anchors that tethered more complicated constructions to the seafloor. And still others may not be animals at all. Common ball-shaped fossils called Beltaniliformis appear to have been fluid-filled seaweeds, comparable in size and structure to the living green alga Derbacea. Relatively few disc-like fossils have been found in Namibia, but elsewhere, in Ediacaran rocks from Australia and spectacularly fossiliferous beds from the White Sea region, Russia, these rounded fossils are far and away the most common components of Ediacaran faunas. There is Cyclomedusa, up to 5 inches across and marked by concentric folds and radial grooves, like a striated cone collapsed along its axis. Then there is Mossonites, similar in size but ornamented by concentrically arranged lobes or bosses. Medusanites is smaller, less than 2 inches across, and smoother, but has a sharply defined circular groove in its center. In contrast, Ovatoscutum sports closely spaced parallel grooves, as though it were fashionably decked out in corduroy. Thin, tentacle-like projections ornament the disc of Hyamalura, and the lobed Inaria resembles a head of garlic flattened against the seafloor. Most paleontologists agree that, in general, these discs represent anatomically simple, bottom-dwelling animals related to living cnidaria, the animal phylum that includes sea anemones and jellyfish. Even those discs shown to be the anchors of colonial animals may find their genealogical home within or near the cnidaria, as discussed later. Perhaps the most unusual interpretation of Ediacaran discs is that proposed by Dolph Zeilacher, the German challenger to Glasner. Zeilacher suggested that at least some of the fossils preserve bizarre sand corals that ingested sediment as a sandy ballast to hold them in place, a rock in a sock, in Dolph's clever phrase. Others, however, including me, believe these fossils are merely socks in a rock, conventional organisms cast in sand. While the closest living relatives of Ediacaran discs may occur among the Cnidaria, no one suggests that Proterozoic disc formers were identical to species alive today. They are extinct taxa that record an early radiation of anatomically simple animals. A second group of Ediacaran fossils consists of complex, often leaf-like forms made up of repeating tubular units. Called vendobionts, these fossils are represented in Namibia by several species. Rengia is an elongate fossil, up to about 6 inches long, consisting of a central axis from which two rows of branches emerge. The branches contain numerous interlocking tubes, each a few millimeters wide. This distinctive form reminds many paleontologists of sea pens, modern relatives of jellyfish and sea anemones, in which simple individuals form complex leaf-like colonies. If Rengia is a colonial animal, then the repeating tubular units may represent its constituent individuals. Sea pen analogies become harder to sustain, however, when applied to other Nama vendobionts. Pteridinium, a second leaf-like form found abundantly in a mid-Nama storm bed, superficially resembles a sea pen, but it has three wings instead of two, and each wing contains a single rank of tubes arranged perpendicular to the main axis. No modern sea pen looks like that. Swartpuntia, found by John Grotzinger at the very top of the Proterozoic succession, also has its tubes arranged in three broad wings attached to a stout central axis, like a Chinese fan imagined by Picasso. And Urnieta is even worse. Its many elongate tubes form a complex cup, possibly open at the top. Vendobionts provide a Rorschach test for paleontologists. Individual fossils have been interpreted as colonial cnidarians, as segmented worms, as primitive arthropods, seaweeds, lichens, and more. At the same time, some paleontologists insist that all vendobionts share a common architecture, and so a common ancestry. It is here that Dolph Zeilacher mounted his most audacious challenge. Dolph proposed not only that vendobionts were all cut from the same cloth, but that the cloth no longer exists. Unimpressed by Glasner's interpretations of Ediacaran fossils as early offshoots of phyla seen today, Dolph declared that vendobionts were quilt-like organisms made up of cylindrical tubes filled with plasmodial fluid rather than cellular tissue. Interpreted this way, vendobionts seem foreign, more alien than animal, and this was precisely Dolph's point. In 1992, he formally proposed the Vendobionta as an extinct kingdom separate from the animals, an experiment in macroscopic multicellularity that blossomed for a geological moment, but ultimately failed. Earlier interpretations of vendobionts raised only eyebrows, Dolph's raised hackles, and so inspired a new generation of research. Nama fossils serve to introduce the odd morphologies of vendobionts, but other localities show their true diversity. Harniodiscus is a spectacular fossil first discovered in Australia. Like Rengia, it is leaf-like in form, with a large 3-inch disc-like holdfast that anchored an originally erect axis to the seafloor. 30 to 50 lateral branches depart in rows from either side of the central axis, and each branch bears a flap on one face, marked by parallel grooves. The entire fossil can be more than a foot long. In Zeilacher's view, Harniodiscus is a typical vendobiontid alien. But Richard Jenkins, a respected paleontologist at Adelaide University, interprets Harniodiscus more conventionally as a colonial cnidarian organized much like a living sea pen. Unlike living sea pens, however, the branches of Harniodiscus were fused together to form an unbroken surface. Charnia, first discovered in the Charnwood Forest of England and now also known from Newfoundland, Australia, and Russia, superficially resembles Harniodiscus, but has no central axis. Its branches consist of tube-like units arranged in parallel and tightly joined between rows to form an intricately quilted surface. Phylozoon was also quilted, but apparently spread across the seafloor like a miniature throw rug. Perhaps the most thoroughly studied, and therefore most hotly contested, vendobiont is Dickinsonia, known from large populations in Australia and the White Sea. Dickinsonia is an elliptical fossil made up of cylindrical tubes joined along their long axes to form a continuous surface. Specimens may be as small as a penny or as large as a turkey platter, but they are never more than a few millimeters thick. A narrow but pronounced ridge runs down the middle of the long axis. Mary Wade, a colleague of Glasner's at the South Australian Museum, first described Dickinsonia as an annelid worm, interpreting the transverse tubes as body segments and the central ridge as a gut cavity. She proposed the living annelid worm sphincter as a modern counterpart, although the flattened shape of this worm is highly unusual and not at all primitive within the phylum. In contrast, Misha Fedunkin, the affable Russian who brought the White Sea fossils into focus, proposed that the tubular segments of Dickinsonia meet along the central axis but do not cross it. If Fedunkin is correct, and more than one disciple of Glasner has contested his interpretation, Dickinsonia could not possibly be an annelid. To Dolph Zeilecker, of course, Dickinsonia is just one more extinct vendobiont. Was Dickinsonia a worm or a failed experiment? An early ancestor of familiar animals, or an extinct life form only distantly related to living invertebrates? Interpretation isn't easy, and I can easily find someone to disagree with any opinion I might venture. But a few clues shed light on the case. UCLA's Bruce Runiger and Jim Gelling of the South Australian Museum discovered folded specimens which show that Dickinsonia had a flexible body. A handful of fossils also provide evidence that tubes could contract and so must have contained muscle cells. And rare specimens in which tubes ripped open but retained their cylindrical shapes suggest that whatever filled these structures, it wasn't plasmodial fluid. That's one strike against the vendobiont hypothesis. On the other hand, Dickinsonia shows no evidence of the organ systems expected in annelid worms. There is no mouth at the end of the medial ridge, no hair-like setae, and no peripodia, stumpy leg-like appendages on the body segments of marine annelids. Early in the game, it was possible to blame such absences on preservation, but that won't work anymore. What we see is pretty much what was there. Ediacaran rocks contain trackways that could have been plowed by smaller dickinsonids, but few trails that could, even in principle, be associated with larger specimens. Apparently, then, Dickinsonia reclined on the sediment surface but did not move across it, very unlike a worm. And one more observation supports the interpretation of Dickinsonia as a vendobiont. The arrangement of its tubes closely resembles that seen in the fan-like wings of the three-pronged Nama fossil Swartpuntia. I confess to some uncertainty in interpreting these perplexing fossils. Vendobionts don't seem to develop like modern algae, and they don't look like living worms. But neither am I convinced that they record, like Shelley's statue of Ozymandias, a vanished kingdom in an antique land. What is the alternative? Taking a cue from Rangia and Harniodiscus, I suspect that most vendobionts were colonial animals at least broadly related to the living cnidaria. Today, coloniality is widespread among cnidarians, from the Portuguese man-of-war that floats on the sea surface. Its float, stinging tentacles, and reproductive structures are all anatomically complete individuals, to the massive reef corals and delicate sea fans that proliferate on the ocean floor. In the absence of well-developed organ systems, cnidarians achieved complexity by differentiating individuals within colonies, and this may have been the case for vendobionts as well. Tube-like individuals in vendobiont colonies must have had a simple anatomy, but like living cnidarians, they could have had both nerve nets and functionally coordinated muscle cells. Moreover, the structurally competent material within tubes could have been an inert substance like the jelly in jellyfish. And, as Mark McMenamin of Mount Holyoke College first speculated, vendobionts might have gained nutrition from symbiotic algae or bacteria, as, once again, do many living cnidarians. Could have, might have, much remains tantalizingly beyond our grasp. However, by viewing the complex shapes of vendobionts as colonies built by individually simple animals, we can interpret most, if not all, of these fossils as members of a single clade, and one that vanished long ago. I suspect that vendobionts do not comprise an extinct parallel to the animal kingdom, but rather record early animals that possessed some but not all of the features found in living cnidarians. Cnidarian features not found in vendobionts include a mouth fringed by tentacles. Indeed, in limited retreat from the extinct kingdom hypothesis, Dolph Zeilecker and Yale's Leo Buss have suggested such a possibility. Sherlock Holmes famously recognized the importance of absence, of missing clues and things that did not happen. Is there any other point to which you would wish to draw my attention? To the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime. The dog did nothing in the nighttime. That was the curious incident, remarked Sherlock Holmes. Absence is also worth noting in Nama and other latest Proterozoic rocks, and the fossils most obviously missing are those found so conspicuously in Cambrian rocks deposited only 10 to 20 million years later. Ediacaran discs and vendobionts suggest that cnidarian-like animals were common in latest Proterozoic ecosystems, but where were the ancestors of trilobites, of mollusks, of brachiopods, of us? Absence of evidence is suggestive, but when are we justified in interpreting it as evidence of absence? The answer, as always, lies in sampling. Cambrian rocks tell us where and under what conditions complex animals became fossilized, and only when we have searched thoroughly in all the right Proterozoic rocks can we have confidence in an evolutionary interpretation of missing fossils. Cambrian rocks contain the tracks, trails, and burrows of anatomically and behaviorally complex animals that inhabited shallow seaways. In the cliffs along the Cotuican River, their abundance and diversity increased dramatically as we climbed higher into the Cambrian succession. Nama sandstones also contain tracks and trails made by early animals as they moved through bacteria-rich sediments just below the surface of the seafloor. The trackways are small and simple, about the size and shape of a spaghetti strand dropped carelessly onto the floor, figure 10.2. The tracks run parallel to the sediment surface and rarely penetrate to even modest depths. But, based on observations of living trail formers, it appears that most of these traces were made by creatures more complicated than sea anemones and jellyfish. Animals that make tracks like these have one distinctive feature in common: bilaterally symmetric bodies in which a single plane of symmetry runs from head to hind end. Bilaterian animals, discussed further in Chapter 11, include all anatomically complex metazoans from trilobites to vertebrates. Trace fossils document their presence in latest Proterozoic oceans. Might bilaterian animals also lurk among Ediacaran impressions? Some fossils from Australia and the White Sea are neither discs nor vendobionts, and these provide a hunting ground for more complex animals. Tribrachidium, for example, is a circular cast that might easily be lumped with Ediacaran discs, except that it displays three large grooves that branch repeatedly as they spiral outward from its center. Along with a handful of related fossils from the White Sea, Tribrachidium has variously been allied with the sponges, cnidarians, or echinoderms. Its affinities, however, remain problematic. Three-part symmetry is rare among living animals. Functionally, the canal-like internal structure suggests an animal that flushed large volumes of seawater through its body, as sponges do today. More promising are other small fossils that resemble arthropods to a greater or lesser degree. Parvancorina consists of shield-like molds, mostly less than half an inch long, figure 10.3. A pronounced rim runs along the outer margin, while the interior displays a T-shaped ridge whose top curves along the rounded front edge. Faint lines, sometimes interpreted as legs, can be seen beneath the shield. Parvancorina certainly exhibits bilateral symmetry, and looking at it, one can hardly avoid thoughts of trilobites. But of course, Parvancorina is not a trilobite, and though it has certain features reminiscent of this group, it lacks a host of additional characters evident in trilobites, lobsters, crabs, and all other arthropods. The same can be said about an assortment of other Ediacaran fossils, including Precambridium and Vendia. Spriggina, named for Ediacara pioneer Reg Sprigg, is particularly intriguing in this regard. Its 2-inch body has both segments and what appears to be a rounded head shield, very like an arthropod. Dolph Zeilecker rather hopefully interpreted it as a vendobiont made up of interlocking tubes, but many other paleontologists see Spriggina as a segmented, bilaterally symmetric animal, arthropoid, if not truly arthropod. Finally, there is Kimberella, a small organism that looks like a smoked mussel preserved in rock. According to Misha Fedunkin and Ben Wagoner of the University of Central Arkansas, this resemblance is more than coincidental. They interpret Kimberella as a bilaterally symmetric organism that possessed a muscular foot for locomotion, a bag-like body packed with visceral organs, and a tough organic mantle over its back. These features all occur in mollusks, the phylum that includes mussels and clams, along with snails and squid. Like Spriggina, however, Kimberella lacks other features found in the living animals to which it is compared. Such fossils are both exciting and frustrating. Exciting because they show flashes of a familiar biology, and frustrating because individually familiar characters occur in decidedly unfamiliar combinations. If, however, we can lay aside the urge to see modern animals in Proterozoic fossils and accept Ediacaran morphologies for what they are, the balance tips strongly toward excitement. The unmistakable sense I get from Ediacaran fossils like Kimberella and Spriggina is that they preserve early stages in the assembly of features that collectively mark Cambrian animals as modern. Ediacaran species weren't there yet, but at least some were on their way. Contrasting the simple trace fossils below the Proterozoic Cambrian boundary with the more abundant, diverse, and complicated tracks and burrows found above supports the idea that something big really did happen at the start of the Cambrian period. But much of our sense of Cambrian diversity comes from skeletons preserved in carbonate rocks. The Nama group contains plenty of limestones. Thus, it offers one more test of evolutionary pattern. Do Nama carbonates contain ancient skeletons? If so, do these fossils establish biological continuity between Proterozoic and Cambrian animals, or do they reinforce the differences between the two? Generations of paleontologists regarded the origin of mineralized skeletons as synonymous with the Cambrian explosion. In 1972, however, Gerard Herms showed this view to be wrong. In the course of his field research in Namibia, Herms discovered small tubes made of calcium carbonate in Nama limestones, figure 10.4a. Herms christened these fossils Cloudina in honor of Preston Cloud and recognized two species, one of which he named for his mother. Claudina hartmanni and Claudia reimkii differ in size, the first an inch or two long and a quarter inch wide, the second smaller by a factor of two, but they share a common organization. The fossils are gently curving cylinders ornamented by closely but irregularly spaced flanges that protrude outward, the whole resembling a series of tiny funnels stacked one inside the next. Pogonophoran worms, distant relatives of earthworms, live in tubes built like this, but simpler animals can form mineralized tubes as well. In fact, rare specimens found in China are branched, suggesting that, like Ediacaran discs, Claudina might be related to sea anemones and jellyfish. Skeleton walls are thin and appear to have been flexible in life. Claudina probably sported only a light coat of calcium carbonate. Claudina is important because it shows that animals learned how to build mineralized skeletons well before the Cambrian period began. But how much do we wish to make of this? Is Claudina a singularity, the exception that proves the rule of Cambrian biomineralization? Or was it part of a larger assembly of latest Proterozoic animals that presaged the skeletal diversity of Cambrian faunas? Here, at last, we return to the Namma reefs mapped by John Grotzinger. The reefs are astonishing to see in the field, great lumps as much as 200 feet high that rise out of the desert floor, excavated in recent millennia by erosion that peeled away encompassing shales, figure 10.1. The architects of the reefs were microorganisms, likely including algae as well as cyanobacteria, but skeleton-forming animals also found happy homes in small niches set high above the flat seafloor. Animal fossils are abundant in Namma reefs, and, judging from cross-sections seen on weathered rock surfaces, they came in a variety of shapes and sizes, figure 10.4b. Tubes are common, although only a few display the flanges that identify them as Claudina. More abundant are rounded cups up to an inch or so wide. Then there are goblet-shaped fossils with cup above and tube below, and fossils with clear hexagonal symmetry. John and I spent hours crawling along these reefs, trying to figure out what kinds of animals were present and how many different species were represented. Those are difficult questions to address in the field, because the fossils can't be freed from the rocks that contain them. To find an answer, we had to cart large slabs of rock back to Cambridge, where John designed a system to prepare a smooth surface of each, and then slowly grind away the surface 25 microns at a time, taking a carefully registered digital photographic image after each shave. Using software originally developed for medical research, the library of digitized cross-sections was assembled into three-dimensional virtual fossils, figure 10.5. Wes Waters, a bright MIT student with a head for physics but paleontology in his heart, did most of the work. The computer models are eerily lifelike. They seem to bob and sway in some virtual current. The reconstructed fossils look like flexible wine glasses with a cylindrical stem that opened upward into a round cup as much as an inch wide. Six, rarely seven, regularly spaced holes impose a hexagonal pattern on the cups. As in Claudina, the walls of these cups were thin and flexible, and so could have been mineralized only lightly. Evidently, early animals had little need for the robust mineral skeletons that protected their descendants from predators. Given virtual fossils, we can simulate cross-sections in any plane we wish, and when allowance is made for crushing and bending, nearly all of the tubes, cups, and goblets seen on reef surfaces can be interpreted as slices through a single form. Cyphopolyps, goblet-shaped relatives of, once again, jellyfish that attach to seaweeds in the present-day ocean, provide at least a general guide to the Namma fossils. Clearly, Claudina was not the only skeleton former in the Namma Seaway. Namacalathus, the goblet of Namma, thrived wherever microbial communities paved the seafloor, and continuing studies show that other mineralizing species were present as well, including coral-like animals that colonized cracks in the reefs. But just as clearly, diversity was limited. We may have discovered abundant new fossils in the reefs of Nama, but there are no bivalves or arthropods, no brachiopods or echinoderms. When we have searched everywhere we can, latest Proterozoic life still looks very different from the Cambrian. On a sun-baked afternoon in Namibia, John Grotzinger and I stroll along the crest of an isolated hill, taking one more look at some of the youngest Proterozoic rocks exposed here or anywhere. The rocks are full of fossils, the Vendobionts, Swartpuntia and Turridinium, Calcareous, Claudina and Namacalathus, and trace fossils of modest diversity. These preserve a record of animals, but animals of distinctly Proterozoic aspect, far different from the diverse and complex invertebrates found in Kotuikan cliffs. The most conspicuous Nama fossils are to Cambrian animals what dinosaurs were to the mammals that graze on the plain below us, ecological antecedents, but not direct ancestors. Nama fossils would provide cold comfort to Darwin, who believed that Cambrian complexity took shape gradually over long stretches of Proterozoic time. Now it seems that the familiar biology of Cambrian seas emerged only as the Cambrian period began. What was wrong with Darwin's solution, first considered along the Kotuikan River? How far had animal diversification progressed by the end of the Proterozoic eon? And what ushered in the Cambrian world?